session number 8941, rule number 2.
Major Jefferson, rule 2.
Are we on? You use the word culture shock. And I don't think that I was really sufficiently intelligent to be shockable. Culture change, yes. I certainly arrived there thinking that the English were the heirs to paradise. I certainly didn't credit the Indian races with the virtues that I now credit them with, but they taught me lessons. The first lesson I remember very clearly was I was in the mess on the mess veranda with an old, he was one of what I call the Calcutta Jute Wallers, but he wasn't actually a Jute Waller. He was, he grew things up on the Assam frontier, I think. And I watched one of the gardeners or bearers go off into the vegetable patch with his little pot of water. And I remember saying something like, filthy blighter. And this old, it was Assam tea planter, that's right. This old Assam tea planter said, you realise, of course, that he thinks you're a filthy blighter because you use toilet paper. And when you think it out, he may be right. And I think that was a lesson that I learnt then. And I remember another lesson I learned later on, after July 42, but on the Wisat Ridge, where I was supporting a company of PMs, and the gunner used to go out about 1,000 yards in front of the infantry onto the next ridge. And I came back that night to find that my PMs had been relieved. And I said to the Subedar in charge, Salaam Saab. And he said to me very gently, we Sikhs don't say Salaam, we say Sat Sri Akal, which means there is one God. And next day when I came back, I claim no virtue for this, it just happened that I remembered to say Sat Sri Akal. And the effect on that chap and upon his whole company and indeed his whole battalion thereafter was quite remarkable. So yes, India was a change. I think it was a culture shock. It was more the British in India, because I had a sickness. This is why I lost my third pip, in fact. I was sent up to Nainital, to the hills. And there, the first thing I had to do was to get on a horse. And getting on a horse is a frightening thing as far as I'm concerned. But there, the whole attitude there, in the short time I was there, I made a friend of a girl who was a nurse in a hospital. And it was only months later that I discovered why the lady I was staying with, who was extremely kind, but she was terribly upset at the colour of my girlfriend's nail half moons, because although she was as white as you or I are, it showed that she had some Indian blood, I'm told. But of course I'm looking back now from 45 years later, and how one reacted at the time I don't know. Maybe I we were all children of our generation, and the views that one held in those days were the views that were current amongst readers of the Morning Post at that time, just as today my views are those of the reader of the Times. And certainly there was an extremely interesting interaction, but I don't think shock is the word that I would use.
While you were in India, were you aware of what was going on in North Africa?
Well, we had the British news. 1,500 metres was, I think, the where we got it on. So we had the British news, and we were very much aware of the surge up and down the desert. And of course, we watched it with the realization that we were probably next, or next but one. Because that's what we were training for. There's no doubt about that. And it was something of a surprise when we actually got into Iraq rather than the desert. The desert was where we thought we were, because the 4th Indian Division was, of course, had been out there for a long time, so had the 5th Indian Division. We were in India, I think we were the 6th Indian, because we were under... yes, I'm sure that was the name of the chap who runs the 6th Indian Division. When we were in Iraq, we were in the 8th Indian Division. And when we got into the desert, we were the 10th Indian Division. And after the events of July 42, we were 5th Indian Division. And then for 4 years, I was 4th Indian Division. The division, 6th Indian... No, 8th Indian Division was formed in Meerut by C.O. Harvey, that's right, yes. So he must have been 8th Indian Division way back in those days. I thought we were 6th Indian for a time.
Did you feel any sense of divisional identity? Was that an important factor in your thinking?
In Meerut, in India, no. In Iraq, well, I was sick so much of the time that even having a brigade identity was quite difficult. But I doubt if I remember the number of my brigade today if I hadn't been interested in the history of it. No, I don't think we were particularly interested in anything there. I remember the Orc coming around. We were great believers in the Orc. I don't think that when we got in the desert even, we were initially... we changed... command so fast that one couldn't be. But certainly from the time when Sarah had a shite hawk on one's arm, made by the ladies of the Punjab, then there was an enormous and it grew and it grew and it grew, but it grew very quickly too.
So what was the main focus of loyalty? Was it just
the regiment?
The regiment, yes.
Fritz Fowler was 11th Field until he left.
You say you were training for desert warfare while in India. Was that training effective and realistic?
Well, we used to go out to Tuklabad and do shooting. Training for shooting is, I think that was as good as any. And indeed, when we did get into action, every one of the officers had served on a gun. We all were competent OP officers, or as competent as whatever is, and we'd all done, I think this would be in Iraq rather than India, though I believe we probably started in India. We'd all done anti-tank firing with a Bren gun mounted on the gun, so you could actually fire at things. And indeed that paid off on the 2nd of July, or the day I'm interested in, when several of the officers actually got onto guns and fired them in anger.
Why do you have the Bren gun mounted on it?
Well, because you can then actually fire it if you want to. If you've got a moving target, you get a tank or an armoured car to tow something, and you can actually fire the Bren gun at it. Instead of pooping off 25 pounds, you fire a couple of rounds of Bren gun. Or one round. It wouldn't be a Bren gun those days, it'd be a Sten gun. Well, what was the other one? It would be a Bren, wouldn't it? Yes, the first was the Bren.
So this was aiming off for a crossing target?
Yes, yeah. And you could then see if you actually hit, because just one three round is not quite as damaging as a 25-pound solid shot. To come back on this training, I had another point that I was going to mention. You said, was it useful for the desert? I've forgotten the point. We'll perhaps come back to it.
I said, was it effective and realistic?
Yeah. Realistic. Well, of course, we used to do the old smoke puffs underneath the miniature range, but no, we did a lot of training. Yes, I remember the point now. I think our firing training was extremely effective and realistic. I think we later benefited from one of the things that broke my captaincy, which was march discipline. Because I'm pretty night blind, and we did a lot of night marches. And my battery commander at that time was a chap called Pat Waterfield, who later commanded the Oman, the Sultan of Oman's forces. Now, Pat was a bit of a stickler for discipline and a biter. And I remember being stretched out on, they were these Chevrolets with rounded wings, and I was stretched out, if that's the lamp, I was stretched out like that, but I still couldn't keep my 150 yards. And I got a hell of a rocket from Pat and was sent out to do it again one night. Now, one's memory of it, one tends to be blamed for some of the one's fault, but at the same time, our march discipline was a damn sight better as a result. And indeed, on the 29th or 30th of June 1942, when we passed the Ork in the desert, we were marching at 150-yard intervals and in good military discipline. And
were you trained for the domestic aspects of life in the desert, the field hygiene, the sighting of slit trenches, tentage, that sort of thing? Did you cover all that as well as the shooting?
I think by now it came so naturally to us that you don't go pooping off everywhere in India. You're used to thinking of hygiene and digging trenches, and we weren't quite as wasteful of petrol in those days as we were later on in the desert when we made the desert rose. But hygiene with a regular regiment, that's been stationed in India for many years, they're all aware of what hygiene is, and you don't have to train in it.
Did you do any combined arms training in India and in Iraq and so on before going to the Western Desert?
By combined arms, you mean with infantry and with armoured cars?
Yes.
I didn't know that we had any tanks there, but we certainly had armoured cars. Yes, indeed, the day we got our call across the desert, across from the north of Iraq, according to my colonel's dictionary, his diary, we were out with, I was just looking for it earlier, because I think we were out with your friends, the Sussex. And of course, by the time we got across the desert, we'd already invaded Iran. We went up to Ahwaz. I didn't personally, because I was sick. I remember unloading my guns at we got to Shaiba, but this would be over the Shatt al-Arab, and seeing a gun swinging and not caring, I went down with a mixture of sandfly fever, malignant malaria, relapsing fever, and of course as a result got jaundice. and the curves were, as one curve was going up, the other one was going down, and doctors were flying all over the Middle East to look at me. And I was in hospital in the north of Iraq or the south of Iraq, both, for several months off and on. And I remember one day around Christmas of that year, I actually had a chap brought into one side with heat stroke and a chap brought into the other side with frostbite. North of Iraq and south of Iraq being so divergent. Yes, we were used to being a mixed unit, and we did brigade exercises. And I say, I think we were actually on a brigade exercise on the 9th of June when the call came across to go across the desert.
And had you had exercises to cooperate with aircraft?
I don't think we did in India, though there is a reference in the regimental history to an Indian OP, Air OP at one stage. I think we must have had some. Well, I certainly knew how to control fire by the clock method fairly early on. I did, in fact, after the North Africa, I think it must have been after North Africa, do a naval bombardment course. But I think that was after the event you're interested in.
Could you say a bit more about the clock method, about how
it Well, it's, instead of bracketing, as a gunner does, drop 800 and then split it, controlling by 5 o'clock, 11 o'clock, the position on the clock in relation to the target and you. Don't ask me in any detail now, because that's a long time ago, but the actual method of using a clock instead of a bracket
is one that
I associate with aircraft and with ships.
For air spotting?
Yeah.
Because presumably bracketing only really referred to range, didn't it, rather than direction?
Well, you get, was it the OT, officer target, OTFT, something like that, ratio, which also affects the line, but you correct the line separately.
But that would be expressed in terms of mils or degrees, wouldn't it, rather than up and down.
In my LTA regiment, when we got back from France, and we were equipped with some French 75s and some American 75s, it was expressed in mils and degrees and in metres and in yards, and that's a command post officer's nightmare. But on a 25 pounder, it's just degrees and yards. But I mean, one can easily correct from 5 o'clock to the centre. And if the chap's got a plotting thing at the other end, he can. An aircraft up there would say that was 5 o'clock, about 400 yards in those days.
That would depend upon the officer in the aircraft having a very precise knowledge of where the actual gun position was, wouldn't it?
Very informative about the gun position, because I don't. Because I don't remember, but I'm sure in those days the Air OP chap used to fly straight down the line of the guns, and we used to give him a clock position. What I do remember about the air in those days was the defence of Habonea, when little gladiators were flying in such tight circles that they were shooting down Messerschmitts. And I'm sure that I think you'd probably better skip this, because I'm not quite certain when one first did Air OP shoots. But we Lysanders are things that I certainly associate with the desert. Whether we actually did one shoot with them or not, I can't remember, if we're quite honest.
And when you got the... Where were you when you got the order to go to Egypt? Were you back with the regiment?
Oh, I was back with the regiment, and because I'd been ill, I'd been sent up to north of Rwandese, in the Rwandese Gorge, beautiful country, Kurdistan. We went up from the plain. You get from the plain to a barrier, you look down, this wind devils all the way down the plain, then you climb up into the hills. And I remember going around a corner, and on this corner there was an old man with a pipe. It would be a pipe like that, a Kurdish pipe, like that one down the door there. A turban and a pipe. Sorry, that's it. That's it. Yeah? There. He was sitting poised, and of course they all had rifles in those days. It was a very narrow defile. And I remember hoping that the natives were friendly. And as we got round the corner, there was a smell of burning wood. And everyone in the truck said England and bonfires, or words to that effect. Yeah? And we got up there, there's a lovely valley. And we started to dam a river to make a little swimming pool. And we just had one bathe ourselves when the call came back. And we got back and we set off 1,500 miles.
When the call came to move to Egypt...
Yeah?
How long did it take for the regiment to get itself packed up to move and do this journey of 1,500 miles?
I can tell you that exactly because I have the facts in front of me here. We got the call... I got the call up there on the 9th of June. I'm pretty certain of that date. And we actually moved. And I can find it quickly. Just switch off for a second. I have my CO's diary here. It doesn't say anything except for these days that I've got in front of me. And on the 8th of June, and this relates to your question about mixed combined operations, he was on a training scheme with the Dorsets. And discussion of the scheme at 1,100 hours. I was up in the hills, as I said. And it was anti-tank training. It's crossed out, cancelled, with the Dorsets on the 9th. And it was that day that the message came, the 9th, that he received the message. And I was up there in the mountains. We actually left Mosul, which means we must have already come down from Kirkuk, on the 11th of June, Kiara on the 12th of June, Kabrit on the 13th of June, Baghdad on the 14th of June, arrived Baghdad on the 14th of June, left Baghdad on the 15th of June, Habaneya on the 16th of June, that was the RAF station, LG5 on the 17th of June, that was a landing ground out in the desert. This is the line of the Nairn bus company took across the desert in those days. H3 on the 18th of June, H3 standing for Homs Pumping Line 3, H4 on the 19th of June, Mafraq on the 20th of June, Gibat Olga on the 21st of June. Now, Gibat Olga is what I believe I've got as Hadera in my reference, but it's a watering place on what was the Palestinian coast in those days. Beautiful spot. Left Gibat Olga on the 22nd of June. Left Aslag on the 23rd of June. Left the canal area on the 24th of June. Stayed in Cairo on the 25th and 26th. 27th of June, joined 50 Div just outside Mersin Matruh. I have the 27th of June in nearly all the evidence that I can find. The official record still says the 28th of June, but I know one of the probable reasons for that. That is... Excuse me. When we got to Sidi Hanes, just outside Mersin Matruh, were cut off, and we were told to march out south and east. South and east and north. That very night, we broke out. We lost a troop of £25 and a troop of two-pounders while we were doing it. But we broke through and got through. The 11th HAC, the Honourable Artillery Company, 11th HAC, were a little to the north of us, and they got out that night too. But they received a message calling them back. They were called back that night, and they got back. They actually had to break out twice. Now, eventually on the 2nd of July, we were both fighting together. But we got out in one, and they got out and went back again. And I think that's caused considerable confusion, apart from the fact that the people who wrote these damn things were just very tired, and usually doing it perhaps quite a period later. I wouldn't even trust my CO's diary to the extent he probably wrote it in hospital when he'd been wounded, but it was written very close to the event, because his wound is actually one of the few features in it. So I've learnt not to trust any of the records of this particular period to within 24 hours until you've got multiple confirmation.
March, doing it by stages, was this a recognised route that you took?
Well, as I say, the Ork, and I think it was probably Dorman O'Gorman, or whatever his name is, G1, who actually wrote out the orders, but the Ork took this decision to denude his northern flank, and we weren't the only people marching along it, because 18 Brigade had gone along it already, 32nd Field had gone along it, 25th Field. Well, they were all the guns and one brigade of the 8th Indian Division went along the same route at different times. So that if I say a staging post, it probably means a water pipe and a tent. One tent, probably not more. Or it may mean Cowley Barracks. But these places across the desert, it was a fairly well-used trail.
Was any of it on properly constructed road, or was it just on tracks?
Well, you didn't need to construct a road. I mean, I think the best answer I can give you is the Nairn bus service, which when I was recovering from my illness, I had this lovely leave in for health reasons in Beirut. Now, the Nairn bus service just drove out of Baghdad along the metal road and headed west. The actual body of the Nairn bus service, this really was a culture shock to me, because this was like a modern aeroplane chassis on an articulated frame. And it was beautifully air-conditioned, which was a new thought to young Jeffson. It really was the comfort of a modern aeroplane with a bit more room on an articulated lorry. And the driver just drove, and the desert was open, and it was, provided he knew where he was going, there was firm sand, and eventually he'd stop and check on some petrol on the side, we'd have some tea. And very much the same with our 1,500 weights and guns, quads, coming a few months later, a bit south-east, south-west of where I'd been with the Nairn bus earlier.
How did you navigate a convoy across open desert then?
We undoubtedly had bearings. I would suspect that there was probably enough of a used track not to have had to go in for a complicated desert navigation. I mean, we were all in those days competent desert navigators, and we had our little sundial things beside the truck. and I think it would have been fairly hard to have got any of us lost at that period, because you develop sixth sense. I mean, even today, if I see